This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Joe Palca. Ira Flatow is away. This week, Matthew Amarello, the Massachusetts Turnpike Authority chairman, resigned after facing increasing criticism of his management of the Big Dig, a huge tunnel project through Boston that's been called one of the biggest feats of engineering in the country. Earlier this month, concrete panels weighing several tons each fell from the ceiling of part of the tunnel, killing a woman. The panels were held up by a system of bolts and epoxy glue embedded in the roof of the tunnel. Inspectors now say that over 1,400 of the bolt hangers will need to be reinforced for safety. This hour, we're going to talk about engineering structures and some of the basic building materials that make up the world around us, materials like concrete, steel, and wood. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we're talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com. Now I'd like to introduce my guests. Stephen Kramer is a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering and is Associate Dean of Academic Affairs in the College of Engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joins us from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Joe. Delighted to be here.
Great. And we also have with us Christopher Earls. He's the editor-in-chief of the Americas of the international journal Steel and Composite Structures and is an associate professor in the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Cornell University and is, in New York. And he joins us from the studio on the Cornell campus. Welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Pleasure to be here.
Great. So let's, I know that neither of you gentlemen have been directly associated, or I don't believe you're directly associated with the investigation into this problem they've had in Boston. But I'm just wondering, in a theoretical sense, is there a way in advance to say, we have a problem here? Maybe I can put that question to you, Christopher Earls.
So the possibility exists that there may, in a circumstance like this, be some early warning sign in the form of a gross deformation that may present itself and be measurable. And I say gross from the standpoint that it's a large-scale deflection, even though a single anchor bolt may be what the initiator of the failure was. That could be detected, for instance, using some sort of a technique such as related to surveying or something like this.
So how would that work? How would you use a surveying technique to see whether there was any kind of deformation?
So there are technologies that exist where you can map large-scale components to very high accuracies and seek be able to measure what your current condition is compared to some baseline condition, and then be able to gauge a change and how much change has occurred. And this can be as small as fractions of a millimeter using these types of, in this case, laser scanning.
Huh. And what would you do, for example, what would be the next step if you saw one of these deformations and what would you do to prevent something bad happening?
So, again, I'm not terribly familiar with this particular failure or the Big Dig itself. But
right.
If we were to, let's say, scan the tunnel lining or the ceiling of this particular piece that fell, and were to observe that this concrete slab that was about 3,000 pounds, quite large, had moved a millimeter or so. In advance, then perhaps one might want to discern why it was that motion occurred or that movement occurred and go seek the cause.
I see. Okay.
Of course, the challenge.
So, go ahead, Stephen Kramer. On? Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, of course, the challenge is knowing where to look. And the displacements or deformations that Chris described are usually so small that you wouldn't notice them unless you thought you had a problem there in the first place.
Right. When you teach engineers what to look for, what are you teaching them to look for? Stephen Kramer, maybe I can put that to you.
Sure. Well, what we have here, clearly in the case of the Big Dig, something happened there that wasn't supposed to happen. And where it when it occurred and where it occurred, at this point, I don't think we know.
Mm-hmm.
We train engineers to handle risk. This is basically a risk problem to ensure that the load, in this case, the weight of the panels, would be less than the material resistance, in this case, the epoxy in the bolts. And if everyone does their job correctly, then the panels don't fall down. The trick here is that during construction and the design process, of course, things can happen that aren't anticipated. And very few of us, including the public, want to pay for a structure that I would call too safe.
Mm-hmm.
They want to pay for a structure which is safe, but not one that's too safe.
I got it.
And therein lies the challenge.
Yeah, so it's navigating the reasonable amount of safety without making it so safe that it's got 10-foot thick walls. Actually, I heard that necessarily people tend to associate really thick walls with safety, but in some cases that's not the case. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I guess it's a series of engineering decisions that have to be made.
Exactly.
Okay.
And we train our engineers and educate our engineers to be able to look at the numbers and weigh these risks and safeties. Clearly, though, some of this is codified. There are building codes that are legal documents, and engineers, at a minimum, have to meet those requirements.
Got it. Sorry. Did you want to finish that thought?
So I was going to reiterate what Steve was saying.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So I was going to reiterate what Steve had said about there's an expectation on the part of the designer, the engineer, that that which is designed and specified will be constructed in the fashion and manner in which it was intended. And so it's possible, for instance, in this case with the hanger bolts, that they may have been on paper shown to have adequate capacity, but as Steve had pointed out, perhaps there were site conditions that prevented the proper installation of the bolts. I had heard of one instance where there may have been some problems related to the tunnel lining, and so there could have been water infiltrating into the areas where the epoxy should be curing, and potentially that could affect its final strength and so forth. But these are important differences that do occur in the real world that would violate assumptions made by the designer and then could lead to a condition where there may be a compromise in capacity over what was intended.
I'd like to invite one other person to join our conversation. Paul Montero is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of California in Berkeley, and he joins me today by phone from Sao Paulo, Brazil, and perhaps we'll find out what he's doing in Brazil. But thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So you've just written an article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences trying to evaluate the longevity, I guess, of concrete. And I'm just wondering, I mean, given what we just heard about the possibility that water would have gotten into concrete, is that the kind of thing that you have to try to anticipate when you're building a structure with material like concrete that can be deformed if water is dripping into it?
Oh, precisely. The problem with concrete is that if it's not properly done, it can be very porous. And if it is very porous, water can percolate, and life can be even worse because this water could contain some aggressive elements like chloride, sulfates, which can crack the concrete and expand it.
I see. And what surprises me is that concrete has been around since the Greeks and the Romans were building structures. Is there really more to learn about concrete? It seems like that would have been a really well-studied piece of building material.
Oh, of course, this is the natural question that every time when you go to a party, people would always wonder why somebody could spend their lifetime studying concrete. And the fact that the matter it is, concrete is a completely complex material that the pore structures range from the micron size, continue to the nanometers, and the big problems in the construction is that sometimes people don't do a good job, and the imperfection can be in the sizes of inches. So we have a scale of 7 times, which is tremendous. So if you want to do something scientific and modeling, it's quite of a challenge. And if I may, basically the modern is a strong word, but certainly the Roman concrete had two advantages. One of them is the safety factor was tremendous. You see the whatever is left, you see the sizes of everything. The second part is that they do not use reinforcing steel. That is to say, they could not put concrete to tremendous amount of tension, otherwise it would crack. So we have to do something very safe, very economical, and also ecologically correct.
And what would be ecological? I mean, what's the ecological component?
Oh, the ecological part, certainly. Just think in terms of the volumes of concrete that's being used in the world now, which is about 11.5 billion tons per year.
Wow.
In the world. So it's, if you think in terms of the population of the world, we are talking about, what, 6 billion people?
Yeah.
In average, we have just about 2 tons per person per
wow.
year. Now, the question is, to produce cement, we have to generate CO2 in the atmosphere because of the burning process. So for each ton of cement, it generates 1 ton of CO2. So the production of cement, which is used in concrete, is responsible for about 7% of the CO2 emission.
So that's something I hadn't really contemplated. But you're by building a concrete structure, you're contributing to global warming in a sense, or at least to the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. If you believe that's
Absolutely.
Contributing to global warming.
On the other hand, concrete is really, if properly done, I want to emphasize that it's a very ecological process because we can use waste products for other industries. For instance, we can use a huge amount of fly ash, which is a byproduct from the process of burning coal.
Okay. Dr. Montero, I'm going to have to interrupt you there, for we have to take a quick break. But we're talking about the structures that contribute to the things that we live in, work in, build, drive through, what have you. And we'll be taking your calls and talking more about this when we come back after a short break. So stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking this hour about engineering and materials. My guests are Stephen Kramer. He's a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Christopher Earls is an associate professor in the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. And Paul Montero is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of California in Berkeley, although today he's in Brazil. And you're welcome to join the conversation. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And let's take a call right now. How about from Guntram? I think I've got that right, in Newton, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Yes, I have two questions, actually. The first question is, why do they put these bolts in vertically? That seems like the worst possible way of doing it, when you could put it at an angle or even use a pair of bolts at two opposite angles. That's my first question. My second question is, they keep talking about supporting the weight of the slab. It seems to me there's forces much larger to consider. I mean, 10 slabs fell down, not one. So when the first one fell down, I assume what happened is that it sort of wedged itself against the next one, causing it to fall down also and down the line.
Well, Guntram, I have to point out that none of my guests this hour are explicitly working on this particular problem, but perhaps one of you gentlemen can at least make some comment on that. Yeah,
so
go ahead.
Joe, I could. This is Chris.
Hi, Christopher. Go ahead.
I could probably point something out that is indicative of the anchor bolt itself. Is typically you want it to be loaded in withdrawal, which is a uniaxial state of stress, pure tension. And so if you were to put the bolt in at an angle, the bolt then would also be experiencing some bending and beam action. And that actually makes the anchor bolt weaker. And so you try to avoid that in a situation such as this. You would like the bolt to be as strong as it can be, and that would be in a tension-only condition. And so I think that's why it's not angled in.
And this other question about, Guntram says, about panels falling down serially, does one thing lead to another, as they say?
That I don't. I'm not familiar with the configuration of the system in general, so it would be. I could only guess what would cause multiple panels to fall, but sometimes that's not uncommon. Where you would have a, it's still a small scale failure. 1, 2, 3, 4 panels come down. Hundreds of others remain in place. So it still would, in my mind, qualify as a small-scale failure, even though it involved more than one panel, perhaps emanating from a single bolt.
You know, what I'm wondering about in this particular circumstance is people have been building tunnels for hundreds of years, certainly, building bridges for that long and much longer, thousands of years. How is it possible, given those thousands of years of experience, to build something today that doesn't even last a decade? I mean, is that a fair question for someone to ask? Maybe I can put that to you, Stephen, or Christopher Earle. Go ahead.
Sure. This is Steve.
Oh, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a fair question. I think you have to remember is that our materials and our techniques are changing over time. And as Paul pointed out, we're using different additives in concrete than we've used in the past. And with wood materials that I work with, we're combining the wood raw material in different ways into structural members. So our techniques and our materials are changing, and they're changing fairly dramatically. And surprisingly, yes, there's a lot to learn yet about these materials. I think sometimes in our excitement over biotechnology and some of the other so-called hot areas of research, we sometimes forget that these everyday things we don't understand completely yet either.
So maybe I could ask you this. Then there are new materials. If they're being introduced, they obviously have some advantages. Maybe you can talk about the advantages of new materials and the disadvantages, for example, drywall versus plaster.
Sure. Not too long ago, I was doing a study on drywall, much to the amusement of my children at the dinner table, wondering why anyone would study something so unexciting. But it turns out that drywall is ubiquitous in structures. It's used as the primary fire protection mechanism in light frame structures, including houses and apartment buildings and smaller buildings. And we don't know very much about how it actually behaves from an engineering point of view. And we know it works. We know it slows the progression of fire. It's clearly saved lives in many instances, but yet it's never been really researched and fully understood and designed from an engineering point of view. And that's just an example of several holes we have in structures and materials that we need to fill.
Let's take another call now and go to David in Portsmouth, Virginia. David, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, good morning or good afternoon.
Sure.
I'm an engineer. I've worked with bolts for about the last 35 years exclusively, and I had a couple questions. Number one, exactly what did fail? Was it the epoxy? Was it the concrete? Or was it the bolt itself?
Well, David, I want to remind everybody that none of us, none of my guests on this show are explicitly involved in this investigation, so I'm not sure that they can answer that question. But just in general, what are the, maybe we can make it a more general question, what are the possible failure points when a bolt, a hanger bolt fails? Maybe, I don't know, Christopher Earls, is that something?
Sure.
There are some that are obvious. Epoxy, when mixing epoxy, the manufacturer has certain rules and regulations. It's been my experience that the engineers say, here's what we want, here's what happens, and it finally goes down to a mill light someplace down the field, and they mix it up sort of the way they think they're going to mix it up. Quality control of mixing that epoxy has to have been very, very exquisite. It has to be right exactly on the mark. And also wondered what physical restraints would keep that bolt from falling out? Was there a head in there? Was there a cross piece? What would have kept that bolt up in there?
Okay, well, let's see if we have any responses to that. I'm sorry, Christopher Earls, can you address that at all?
Well, so Dave makes an excellent observation from the standpoint that clearly for the epoxy to be properly functioning and to carry out its design intents, it has to be mixed properly and cured properly. And again, there's, you know, just in what's available in media coverage up to this point, there's some indication that perhaps maybe the inside conditions created a circumstance where the curing may not have been able to occur properly, I suppose. But in general, failure modes and bolts are, again, if they're loaded in tension as they're supposed to be, you can have an excessive elongation, like a piece of gum being stretched way too far, and that's one failure mode. And that's gives you a great deal of warning because you could see the bolt elongating and detect distress in the structural system prior to a catastrophic failure. And then the other case would be one that's unfortunate, and that would be a brittle sudden failure, a fracture on a net section. And in that instance, there would be little or no warning, and the bolt would the bolt would fracture and fail. But again, I don't know whether it was a failure in the epoxy or a failure of the bolt itself. All I hear in the media that it's the epoxy, but
right.
I don't know.
Well, there was some mention also in the media today that perhaps some construction nearby or the building that was going on causing a vibration. Maybe I could turn back to Paul Montero and ask, if you build a building out of concrete with a certain set of expectations, or, for example, a dam with a certain set of expectations, and suddenly there's something that changes at the site, can you make any predictions about how the material is going to behave?
Correct. This is always a tough question to address, and indeed, in the design of all these important structures, the engineers made a tremendous amount of scenarios of what could go wrong, because sometimes it will go wrong. So in case of dams that you ask, we try to take care of all the possibilities, and even so, there is always something that goes wrong, or not always, but certainly it could be very small that you can fix without any problem. But it's very rare that a large project would go without any problem. That doesn't mean to say that you expect anybody to have tremendous consequence in a structure. But the point I'd like to address is the extreme need of development of non-destructive techniques. And we are developing completely new standards and setup. In the last 10 years, I would say there is a new revolution on the way non-destructive techniques are being developed. Of course, there is a big transition from the laboratory to the field practice, and it's going a little bit slower, but it's quite expectable that in a short period of time we have new equipment that can address many of these concerns.
So what do you mean by a non-destructive technique? I mean, how does that work?
Right. The standard way of doing things in concrete, because it's so massive, once you cast the structure, you have no clue unless you see cracks that something is really going wrong. And unlike, say, a piece of a small metallic component, say, in a car or an airplane, that you can send an acoustic emission process or sound waves, concrete is very massive, so attenuates these waves. So you want to put a lot of sensors inside and outside the concrete structure and use a system approach and try to identify what's wrong and what's right with the design, and that creates a loop. Things that are going well according to plan, we get confidence. When things do not follow exactly what we predict, we go there and check and inspect. And we do that without doing any damage to the structure.
Yeah, I got it. Well, you know, what's always, this is something that I've always wondered about. Maybe this is my chance to find out, Christopher Earls. There are signs before you cross over a bridge frequently that say this bridge is rated to carry a load of 60,000 pounds. Now, mm-hmm. I saw a cartoon once. It was a Calvin and Hobbes where Calvin, who's a little kid, is asking his dad how they decide what the weight-bearing load is. And he says, well, they keep driving trucks across it until it collapses, and then they rebuild it and then they know how much. I don't think that's the right answer, but but it makes me wonder if – what are the, I mean, you're obviously at some level, you're making an inference about, okay, this material is so strong and this structure is so strong, but you have to assume that the ground isn't shifting or the materials are the way they're, how do they make those kinds of judgments?
Well, in the case of modern design specifications, and not all bridges are designed using these most modern techniques, but as we move forward with design specifications, there's a probabilistic framework that's overlaid on top of the deterministic engineering theories that we use, how much strength will this beam have and so forth and so on. But you're absolutely right. There's a variability in terms of the loading. I can never know with any certainty what types of loads will be on the bridge deck at any given time. In addition, I won't know if those loads are occurring in conjunction with a snowstorm or if they're occurring in conjunction with high winds. In addition, I won't know with any absolute certainty that the steel that I specified for the bridge in my design calculations actually made it into the bridge in exactly the same way that I wanted, or that the alignment of the bridge is precisely the same way that I anticipated. And so these are little variabilities, perturbations to the system that have to be accounted for. And modern design specifications adopt a probabilistic framework so that we could try to come up with what's known as a reliability index, an ability to quantify with some degree of confidence what the probability of a failure will be at an arbitrary point in time.
We're talking about structures, materials that are used to make buildings that we live in, and we're talking about ways of assessing how safe they are and how likely they are to collapse, which I'm happy to say most of the time is very unlikely. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Although I also have to add, in terms of this probabilistic model, that my wife is a bit of a fatalist when it comes to these structures, and she's certain that every parking structure that she drives into is going to collapse while she's parking her car. But I'm glad you're laughing, because I laugh, and she thinks I'm just making fun of her, but I'm not. I'm really...
Well, how many people do you know that have died in a structural collapse?
It's irrelevant. I've tried that argument.
I know, but that's one possible way to...
Right, I got it. But Stephen Kramer, is there an important point here?
Well, I think there's a new sensitivity. Mm-hmm. Ever since 9/11 and then following up with Katrina and Rita last year, I think there's a new sensitivity on the part of the public that buildings are not invulnerable and that they can collapse. And I'm not sure we were thinking about that every day prior to 9/11. I think there's a new sensitivity in the public in that regard.
And what is reasonable for the public to expect given a new building? I mean, obviously, it would be very difficult to design a building anticipating that an airplane would be flown into it. But what's reasonable?
Exactly. It's 9/11 was clearly a very extreme event for which the building was not designed, and it still survived for some time after that impact. But we do have low data, both due to human movements, truck movements, car movements in the case of your parking ramp. We have weather data for snow loads and wind loads, and we can regionalize that data as well. So, for example, in Paul's area in California, we have earthquakes that we have to consider, and yet in Madison, Wisconsin, that's a relatively minor risk. So we have those historical records by which we can characterize loads. And similarly, we have reasonable information about materials and how much they can resist. And that's where the safety index comes in, then ratioing those two to ensure that the chances of that parking garage collapsing as your wife drives into it is extremely small.
I think we have time for one more quick question, so let's try and get that in. Bruce in Berkeley, Massachusetts. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Hi.
I find
it hard to believe that you could have sound engineering practice that puts 10-ton pieces of concrete on top of people driving unless the concrete is absolutely necessary for the bridge. It didn't seem like it was a structural element, and How could it be sound practice to put those things, no matter how they are supported, on top of people if they don't have to be there?
Well, we'll take a crack at that, but we're going to have to keep it short. Paul Montero, maybe you can give a brief answer to that complex question, I'm sure.
It'll be very brief. I'm not familiar with the design at all. The accident happened while I was abroad, so I'm getting very small piece of information. So if anybody has any insight.
Okay, we'll throw it open to others. Do any of you gentlemen have a...
Well, sometimes in a critical application, you try to build in redundancy. And by that, I mean that you don't rely on any single bolt or any single component to keep the structure safe. That's a strategy that is sometimes engineers employ in a life-critical situation. I did not know what kind of redundancies existed or why the panels were needed in the Big Dig.
Okay, well, I'm afraid that's going to have to be where we leave it. I'd like to thank my guest, Stephen Kramer, as a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Christopher Earls is the editor-in-chief for the Americas of the International Journal Steel and Composite Structures and an associate professor in the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Cornell University in Ithaca. And Paul Montero is a professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of California in Berkeley. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you very much, Joe.
And when we come back, some places you might consider going for your summer vacation, although you'll need a lot more than frequent flyer miles to get there. Stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.